Happy Sabbath. Boy, I tell you, this is a friendly congregation. Even from the emails I got from some of you and meeting and greeting you, you all seem to have already taken care of what I'm going to give the sermon on today. So, you know, I can just cut it pretty short. No, it's very exciting to be in a church area like Orlando, which is larger than most. And I don't think you realize this probably, or you've realized it at one time, but Orlando is one beautiful city. Everywhere I drive, it's like the medians are well kept. The roads themselves are actually works of art. I've seen even, I want to stop and see the bus stop area, because not only is it a bus stop, but it has a decorative design over the top of it. It's like, I just can't believe a city where you go everywhere and see such beautiful things. So you have an opportunity here in Orlando to enjoy that beauty. You know, I was working at SEP camp in Orr, Minnesota. It was 72 degrees, negative ions in the air. Those are the good ones, you know. Also, water was gently lapping up on the shore. And I was living in a lakeside cabin about 100 feet from the water. And in my cabin, there was a TV. Why is that so amazing? Because I don't think there was another TV in all of the camp. And every summer, before this summer just about, I ignored anything electronic. But this summer in particular, I was there with my wife, who was working full-time. I was working full-time there, and we had a 3-year-old son. So to be able to do that, there was a break. My wife was working up in the warehouse getting ready for the long wilderness trips that she took. I was in charge of the canoeing, open canoeing for that day, so in 15 minutes I had to go down and help with the kids. And my son was sitting there with me on the couch. We were watching The Magic School Bus. I don't know if you remember that, but it was an educational program for kids. And he was sitting there, and I said, "Son, I've got to go down and help with open canoeing. Do you want to come down with me, or would you like to stay and finish watching The Magic School Bus?" "Magic School Bus, Dad." So I said, "Okay, son, the door's open, the screen door's there, and if you need me, just call out my name. Say, Daddy, okay, and I'll be here, all right?" He says, "Okay." So he goes back to watching his program. I head down to open canoeing, and I'm letting everyone out on the water. It's just beautiful, as I said, beautiful white clouds in the sky. And then all of a sudden, I hear, "Dad!" My heart starts racing, and I think to myself, everything you think speeds up, but really your brain is speeding up, and everything else seems to be going slow. I started running this 100 feet. I bet if you timed me, I would have set a record. I was breathing hard and thinking in my mind, what kind of idiot leaves a 3-year-old alone? I started thinking, what has my son done in the past? He's tried to throw down things down the toilet, like socks and candle. I thought, maybe he put his foot down there and it's caught in the toilet. Or maybe he grabbed the drawer and there was knives in there and it came down. And I bust open that door, look at him, and my son is sitting there, not looking at me, watching The Magic School Bus. And I thought, wait a minute. I said, I know I heard him call out my name. Was this, "Beep"? This is the emergency broadcast system. If there were some useful information, it would follow. There was no useful information following. So as I was breathing hard, "Son," I said, if you don't really need me, please don't call out my name. And all of a sudden, he looked up from The Magic School Bus. He says, "But Dad, I did need you." I said, "Well, what do you need, son?" He thought about it for a minute. He says, "Dad, I love you." Oh, my heart sank. I sat down next to my son. I gave him the biggest hug there was. I said, "Son, if you ever need to tell me that, feel free to call out my name. I don't mind wherever I am to rushing to see you." I went on about my business and finished up the open canoeing and then took him from there, and we finished out camp. You know, I really thought about that for a long time, and I thought, you know, maybe my son is trying to train me. You know, you get a dog and you try to train them, you do little tricks and you do these things. Maybe he was testing that system and seeing if I really would be there. And then I read a book, and I don't remember the author, but it was How to Really Love Your Children. And in that book, he started talking about an emotional tank, and that we all have emotional tanks. And do you know, kids and children show whether their emotional tank is full or empty completely without any fear or reservations. If you're an adult, you hide your emotional tank. It's level. You do your best to hide it. Sometimes you can't. I know when my emotional tank is running dry, it's usually when I'm tired and hungry. Then I realize I start getting short with my family, or my wife is trying to do something for me, and whatever reason, I don't appreciate it. Or my children are trying to talk to me, and I'm ignoring them or something. And I need something to be able to take that emotional tank and fill it. We all have different ways that our emotional tanks can be filled, and it would be good for us to know how that's done. It'd also be even better if you knew how to fill other people's emotional tanks. So how do I know, or how do you know when a child's emotional tank is running dry? You come to church and you have a little three-year-old and you stand above them. Maybe you're a man, has a deep voice. Well, hello. What's the first thing that kid does? Runs back to their mom or dad, squeezing those tight like a barnacle on the bottom of a boat. Oh, they're squeezing so tight. And they all hide behind their mother and may peek out beside there. You just drained their emotional tank. Interesting. If you've drained their emotional tank, how can you ever talk to little kids without draining their emotional tanks? I learned that pretty quickly. A little girl moved up to our church area. She was 3 years old, beautiful red hair. And she was the shyest little girl I've ever seen. So when I see anyone else go up to her, she would shy away and immediately, just like I said, rush back to her mom or her dad, whoever's closest, and squeeze their legs like there's no tomorrow. As a matter of fact, I think I heard her mom squeal a little bit. Oh, she pinched her, you know, because she was squeezing so tight. And I said, well, that's not the way to do it. So I said, first of all, you know, kids, you need to get down on their level, but you don't need to rush up to them and scare them to death. So when Emily come to church, I'd come and get down, say hi, and leave quickly, because I knew the longer I stayed there, because I wasn't her friend yet, that I drained her emotional tank. I have no desire to drain anyone's emotional tank. The next day, you know what I did? I did the same thing. I said, hi, I like your dress. I was gone. She was sitting there and she didn't have time. She did go back to her mother, so I knew I wasn't draining her emotional tank. The next day, I said, hi, I like your dress. I'm glad you're here at church. I was gone. You know, I did this for quite a few weeks, and then one day, I was shocked, because before I could let out, she said, I think you could touch my pinky finger. So I got to touch her pinky finger, and then I let out, you know. So it was funny, because as I worked with her after a while, something actually changed, because she looked forward to my little visits, my quick little visits. One day, I almost always got to church before she did, but she came into church. She saw me from across the room, and do you know what she did? She ran across the room and jumped into my arms. Oh, again, my heart, if you want to say she encouraged me more than any other person could have. One of the ways that I get encouraged is by hugs. Some of you know it because I hugged you twice today, didn't I? Sorry about that. But anyway, the point is that I now had become a source of encouragement for this little girl. Her parents were her source of encouragement. Her older brother was a source of encouragement. And now I was able to develop in such a situation that I was one of her sources of encouragement. Again, I never spent too much time with her at that point even, but I got to know the family. I taught her older brother how to ride his bike and became his close friend. Another two-year-old that was in our church congregation, he was much easier to get to open up. Anytime I'd come to church, he'd come and jump in my arms. So I'm not saying we all have to be that way or that we have to become that type of source of encouragement to all the kids, but I am saying if you want to give encouragement to kids, if you want to give encouragement to anyone, you do have to spend time with them. I've said this before, but, you know, when I'm speaking to a church, I feel like when I'm talking to you, the adults, you're the called out ones and you've accepted God's calling. There's a group of people in all the congregations almost. The young ones have not decided. I love talking to kids and spending time with them. I think it's so important for us to realize it's not just the adults that we need to spend time with. We do need to take out time and spend it with the kids so they know this is not just their parents' church. This is their church too. This is your church too. Why am I just talking to adults? I'm talking to you kids. Yes, it's wonderful. We're trying to do what we can. The church is. With giving you opportunities. I heard that there was school before church started here. That's wonderful. There's camps. There's other activities that your church does. And we really help the kids out all the way through their teen years. And now we're trying to develop programs to help you even after you're a teenager, because we realize there's a gap between there and when you become an adult. So what am I talking about, and what does this relate to? Well, you know, we are in the Passover season. You know, we heard a little bit this in the sermonette today. We should be preparing for Passover, and there's different ways to prepare. But one of the areas I want to talk about is, how do we avoid going to Passover and taking a gift at that season and then realizing someone has ought against us? What am I talking about? What's ought against us? Do you remember reading Matthew 5, 23 and 24? It says, therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and remember your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. I've read that scripture many times, and I think back and try to figure out if there's anyone that I've done something wrong to. And I'll be honest with you, thankfully, most of the time I don't. But there's certain areas that I didn't realize was in this category. Because if you read further, if you read in another book, James, in James 4:17, it says, you know, therefore, if anyone knows to do good and does it not, to him it is sin. Oh, that's interesting. So you mean, even if we don't do something wrong to somebody, it's not enough. It says, when we know to do right to someone, we should do that. So if you can become a source of encouragement to others, if you can practice a life of encouragement, then you're giving to others. I have so many people that during COVID, they stopped attending church, and they would listen online. And then I would try to encourage them to come back to church. There's something that some members don't understand. They say, oh, I can pick out the sermon I think I really need. I can listen to it. I can back it up and listen to it again. And I hear all of these descriptors of how that staying home from church has an advantage over being at church. You know, you're in danger of being in that category of omission. When you think about church is just for me. I go to church because I want to receive what God wants me to hear. I want to hear the sermon. I want to hear the music, if there's special music. Remember, the whole Bible talks about how we're supposed to be loving God and loving our neighbor. So when we go to church, we have a lot more responsibilities than just listening to the sermon and putting it into our lives. There may be someone here that needs your encouragement. I heard Bobby, which I'm sorry, I don't know your last name, but you were in the hospital. Oh, there you are. Hello, Bobby. Yeah, I think you could use some encouragement, couldn't you? You know, you're still having trouble breathing. I think if we're not at church, we don't possibly even know that this past week she was in the hospital. Yes, we get the prayer request and the prayer list, and we should do something about that. But my point is that one of the things that we do before and after church is fellowshipping and getting to know each other and getting to know each other's needs. That is a way that we can find that we have an opportunity to serve by being encouraging to others. Some things I like to do, just because the shock of it, it shouldn't be a shock, but it is. Every time I go to their drive-thru, if you're going to get coffee or a fast food or something, next time you do it, focus on the person that's serving you behind that window. Look them in the eyes and give them a big smile. They'll either think you're crazy or they'll have a smile back for you, and that will make their day. Most of the people they deal with are complaining that they got the wrong order, this is wrong, hurry up, do this. That is a thankless job, a terrible job. Because so many people are all about themselves and focused on it. I'm in a hurry. I've got to do things. I've got to take care of myself. You know, you're my servant. Listen, they're God's children. They're all going to be called at one time or another. So how do we prevent from causing someone to have ought against us? I think we're going to discuss specifically, where does God command us to become sources of encouragement? So I'll back up even from that. There are two great commandments. We know that. We can read that in several places, but Luke 10:27 is one area that we can do that. I'm not asking you to turn there, but You know, the first great commandment is to love God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength. And the second is like unto it. Serve yourself to your might. Oh, wait a minute. Something's wrong about that. What's the second one? What's the second great commandment, anybody? Love your... Thank you. Love your neighbor. The Bible even says, someone asked Christ, who is my neighbor? Anyone you come in contact with, or even anyone you don't come in contact with, is your neighbor. All of God's children are your neighbor. Obviously, you can't encourage everyone, but those that are most close to you in physical contact, you can. Those people you spent time with and now you become a friend is a perfect time that you can show encouragement to them because they already know you care. I think what I've taught all my life, and I think I might get this wrong, but it says, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And that's a practice that we can do in all parts of our life. So today we're going to focus on how we can love our neighbors through encouragement. And I don't think you'll mind, but I'm going to take a lot of this from a book that most of you have heard. And most of you probably have heard a sermon with some of these five things in mind. But the book is called The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman. And I did tell you, I was going to tell you, where does it say that we should encourage each other? 1 Thessalonians 5:11 says, therefore encourage one another and build each other up, just as you have already been doing. Think of the Orlando church as, Thessalonica, because, you're already doing this probably, encouraging. You encouraged me when I came in, so I don't know how prevalent that is here, but hopefully that something I say will help you to even be more encouraging to someone else. So the title of the sermon is Becoming a Source of Encouragement. You know, we need to encourage or show love to our neighbor in a way that will encourage them. As I was talking about the little kids, if you think you're encouraging them by spending time with them and all they're doing is running back to their parent and hanging on tightly, you're draining their emotional tank. My wife, her love language, or what I do to encourage her, and it's not much, all I have to do is fold the clothes and dust. Those are two areas she hates. I don't know why she hates them. That doesn't bother me. But her way of being encouraged is acts of service. So those little acts of service and other things are very encouraging to her. I'm more of a person who likes affirmation. So when we first got married, I was complimenting her on this and on that and on folding the clothes and on dusting and all these other things I was complimenting her on, and it went nowhere. It meant nothing really to her. Most of us, of the five love languages, which I'll mention before I go on because I know I haven't mentioned those, acts of service, gifts, words of affirmation, quality time, and touch. So those are the areas that I'm going to talk about and give you some examples. So the first area that I mentioned already was my son. What was going to fill his emotional tank? All he needed to know is that his dad was near. His emotional tank was running dry, as all little kids' tanks tend to do when they're away from their parents. Have you ever tried to babysit someone for the first time and they cried most of the time while their parents weren't there? They're crying, their emotional tanks are drained pretty quickly because their parents aren't around. And you, if you know how to do this, you try to distract them. You try to get them involved in some game, something that gets them not thinking about their parents, and then their emotional tanks can start to fill up a little bit more. But so my son needed words of affirmation that dad was going to be there, that he saw me. You know, he needed me to spend some time with him, because once your kid's tank has been drained, sometimes it's hard to build it back up. We need to start spending a little time with them, and be there for them. So there's other things that encourage my wife, but for me, as I told you already, I like touch. So when I get home and I'm tired and I'm emotionally drained because things have happened at work, or maybe I got a phone call that was discouraging, something's happened. When I get home, my wife knows the first thing she needs to do is, she doesn't need to talk to me or ask me how my day went, she needs to give me a hug. And when she gives me a hug, I mean, it's just like all the weight lifts just flows off of me. She tells me it's like, put it in a bubble and let it go up to God, you know? Well, I do that when she gives me a hug. I can't just naturally do that. She seems to be able to naturally do that. I want to talk a little bit about gifts, and I'll tell you an example. I was at a bachelor college in Big Sandy, Texas, and I worked on the farm. It was a fantastic job. Many weekends, when I say many, every so often on a weekend, I would be voluntold, you know what that is? I'd be voluntold it was my turn to milk the cows, because the cows have to be milked even on the Sabbath. It would be very, very painful for the cows if you let them go without milking them. So I'd get up at 5 in the morning and head out to the farm. And my mother sent me a message and said, hey, how's everything going? I said, everything's going great, except for I'm a little bit cold when I go out to the farm. I didn't mean to mention it as something that I said, Mom, this is something you need to take care of, but you know moms. So about a week later, I go to the mailbox area and they said, oh, you got something that doesn't fit in your mailbox. I said, oh, I do? And there's this big package. And it was all wrinkled up and everything else, but it was a big package. So I was excited. So guess what? My emotional tank was being filled, even though I didn't know what was inside it. Someone sent me a gift. And then I opened it up, and I was even more excited because she had sent me insulated coveralls. Man, this was a fantastic time. I was going to be warm when I got up to go milk those cows. And, you know, I was so excited. I took it back to my dorm. I immediately tried it on, and I realized there was about 15 pockets, you know. And I said, oh, this is great. I stick my hand in one pocket. Oh. There was a little note from my sister. I hope everything's going well for you. Remember, I'm always the better, the older, and the bigger sister. So my older sister left me a note. I said, oh, that's great. All of a sudden, I reached another note. Do you know how excited I got? All of these pockets, every one of them had a note. My mom had written me a note. My other brother wrote me a note. My younger brother, my youngest brother, my other sister. I have a pretty big family, so, you know, I have lots of pockets, they only filled them. Well, even my dad wrote me a note. I don't know if my dad had ever written me a note before then, but my dad wrote me a note. I've read that several times since then. I've read it over and over again. It was just a small comment, but, you know, he was telling me that he was proud of me. And each one, and whenever there's a pocket that, you know, after all the family had written, there were still more pockets. So I still... Every pocket had a note in it. My mom put a few extra ones from her, you know, so she filled the rest of the pockets. Can words of affirmation do anything? Well, I can tell you they do. I've got tears in my eyes right now just talking to you about it. So has it affected me? Yes, it has. Does it give me encouragement every time I think about it? Yes, it does. So my point to you is, even though you think it's a small thing or a small note that you do, even like the card that's back there today, you know, it'd be really wonderful if everybody in this room took the time to go back there and sign that card. So gifts are wonderful things. They don't have to be expensive. They can be small. But also words of affirmation, words of encouragement. One day, it had been raining really hard and it had been dry before that, so I said, I've got a giant brush pile I've got to burn. And I'd like to be safe, so I said, I'm going to start this fire with just paper. And I'd collected paper over weeks and weeks. I put the paper to that fire, to that brush pile that was soaking wet, and tried and tried and tried to get this pile to burn, and it wouldn't. So after there was no more smoke, there was one side that I was trying to burn, and I walked over to the other side. I said, I can't start this fire. I'm going to put some gasoline on it. Oh, I think I heard some comments already. You're going to be, by the time I get finished with this sermon, you're going to say, oh, well, he's an idiot again. No, I mean, there was no flame. There was no smoke. Where there's smoke, there's fire. There's nothing there. I don't know what happened, but when I started pouring it on there, poof, I caught on fire with the brush pile. And I started hitting my hands, trying to get this fire to stop, and my chest and my face, and it wouldn't stop. So I remembered stop, drop, and roll, and I stopped, dropped, and rolled. And I still kept burning. Then I started screaming at God and said, you said you wouldn't test us beyond what we're able. Not in that quiet voice. I was just beside myself. As soon as I yelled at God, I immediately thought of taking off my shirt. I took off my shirt and it stopped immediately. But the damage had been done. I was life-flighted to Vanderbilt Burn Center, which is one of the best in the world. Now, at the Vanderbilt Burn Center, they drop you off and they fly on the top floor, the fifth floor. And the fifth floor is the burn center, because many times burn patients need care as fast as any other injury or any other sickness that there is. And they rushed me in at this time. I won't tell you too much about what happened beforehand, but at least they had put me under at this point, so I was unconscious, thankfully. And they worked on me, and I was in intensive care, and when I woke up, all my fingers were black like charcoal. All of this arm had third degree burns all the way up here. This ear was as black as coal. I just knew my ear was gonna fall off, my fingers were gonna fall off, and I didn't know what else was gonna happen to me. Because the doctor came in and he said, you're gonna need multiple skin grafts. I'm a teacher. I felt, well, I'm not gonna be able to teach anymore because I'm gonna be so deformed, no one's gonna be able to look at me. A lot of things I felt, I wasn't gonna be able to use my hands. I wasn't going to be able to do many things. I'm telling you this not to gross you out, but to tell you that I received hundreds and hundreds of cards from brethren all around the world. My wife would pull them out and read to me. You talk about being encouraged. Those little cards that you sign mean something. Well, after I was in intensive care for I don't know how many weeks, but I started getting better, and they did do a skin graft. And they took skin from my thigh here, and he said he's going to take it from both thighs, and he put it up here. And then he said, when he went in for surgery, he said he couldn't believe how much I was healing and didn't have to take another skin graft. So, you know, this is wonderful. The only problem is that when I itch down on my thigh, I have to scratch up here. When I itch on up here, I have to... I'm just teasing. Skin grafts actually don't turn into your skin, and... It was funny because they asked me if I would take cadaver skin or would I take pig skin because it's so much like human skin, or would I have to have my own skin? And my wife put on there I wouldn't take pig skin. At the time, I didn't understand skin grafts, but anyway. Another guy that was actually the guy who helps keep you from becoming infected came by to see me personally, and he says, what about this not wanting pig skin? He got to talking to me, and he believed in the food laws, he believed in the holy days, he believed in the Sabbath, and he was attending an independent group, so he encouraged me knowing that there was someone else there that, you know, was from that type of background. But the interesting thing is that, you know, the most encouraging thing was God and God's healing powers. They told me that I could go home with my wife because she was a nurse, and that she had to change my bandages all the time. The fear at that point is infection. The fear originally when they life-flighted me is if I'd breathed in any flames, I'd probably be a goner because it would have ruined my lungs. But after I was in there and they said I could go home, at least if my wife would take care of me there, they said, you're going to have to come back every week for months, and then you'll be able to come back once every month. And so the first week, I got into my special gear that they give you that helps your skin from becoming scars all over, which I didn't wear because it was too irritating. And I came in and the nurse asked me to disrobe. I disrobed and she looked me up and down and she said, wow, you are a good healer. And my heart sank again because I thought to myself, I have a good healer. God had taken care of me, and that was the only time I went back to visit. And as a matter of fact, you can come up closely and look, and you won't be able to see the scars. Some are there, and I have to describe them to you. This ear is a little bit smaller than this one. If I didn't tell you, you wouldn't know it. I can tell you I have third-degree burns on different parts of my body that I can tell you don't take any pigment anymore. Not a good thing in Florida, is it? No, it's okay, because I can wear long shirts that are very breathable. And also, if I put 100% SPF on, I can also do that. As a matter of fact, I work. I worked this summer at a amusement park as a lifeguard. Is that crazy? Well, if you don't mind, I'll tell you a little bit about it, because it relates to a sermon on encouragement. I don't know if you've read the last Compass Check, but the first article in there, I think, is one I wrote about working at Beach Bend Park. I don't even know if I said the name of it, but I decided to go back and work at Beach Bend Park as a lifeguard because I needed to renew my certification so I could help out at our church camps. And there's no certifications that I could find that weren't on Saturdays. So I went to the park, and they said, yeah, we'll train you. And they asked me about my background, and immediately I said, oh, yes, we'll train you. Because I've taught lifeguards in 4 different states. I've held 40 different positions at camps, most of them around the water. And so they were excited, because if you take the class, you have to work for them. So they got a worker for them, because I wanted to be recertified to help out the church. Anyway, I got there the first day, and the first thing I see is, for some reason, I'm the only one there with white hair. Yeah, 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds all sitting there. And when you come in and you're got the lifeguard uniform on, everybody's looking at you. It's like, what? What's going on? This guy must really have a pretty pitiful life. He has to come back. And no, it was funny, because the first day I was there, the teenager next to me was saying, talking to his friend, he says, oh, it might thunderstorm today. I can't wait. We can get out of work early. And then when I was there for a little while, I realized they don't like the job. They don't like being out in the sun because it's too hot. Wait a minute. You took the class. You signed up for the job. You knew that lifeguarding meant you're out in the sun, and you don't like it? My point being is that they hated their job. They didn't want to work. They wanted to get off work, and I'm thinking, how are you going to get paid if you want to get off work all the time? And they were cussing all the time. They'd make fun of the patrons, but only when it was in our meetings. I said, God doesn't want me to be here. Then all of a sudden, I thought back. I said, wait a minute. You know, God tells us to be a light on a hill. How can you be a light on a hill if your only place you go is you're around church members? That's all that you're doing. Anyway, so I changed my attitude. I started being friendly to all the lifeguards. In the morning when we had our meeting, if someone was alone and looked like they were despondent, I'd sit next to them and just talk to them. And it's amazing how easily you can encourage someone. One of the girls I sat next to was 16, and she just looked like she lost her mother. I said, are you okay? She says, no, not really. I'm pretty depressed. I said, oh, do you want to tell me something about it? They gave me the wrong coffee. And then I realized, wait a minute, I'm talking to teenagers. Disasters in their life may be a little different than disasters in my life. So I had to learn that pretty quickly. But I started being friendly and memorizing everybody's name, giving them high fives to the lifeguards as I go by. When the patrons went by, I'd give the little kids high fives. I'd talk to the adults. I'd tell jokes while I'm watching my water. It was amazing the transformation that happened at that park. All the lifeguards loved when I started coming around. And they'd say, hello, Kevin. Hello, Kevin. Anytime I'd come around first, before I got to say anything. And they seemed to start enjoying their job. And they knew I wasn't cussing. And so they stopped cussing so much anytime they were near me. As a matter of fact, it seemed like people were having more fun with each other. One day, I was wearing my long sleeve shirt because I, like I said, for the burn. And a 16-year-old girl came up to me and says, aren't you hot in that long sleeve shirt? I don't know, I'm just fine. After work that day, I saw her talking to the head lifeguard. She said, Kevin needs a short sleeve shirt and I'll pay for it. Now, this was funny to me. She's 16 years old and I'm 62. And she's trying to take care of a 60-year-old man because she liked me, you know? She was friends with me then. But my point being is that I felt like I was making a difference. I wasn't positive, but for instance, the owner is a put-out-the-fires type person, and all you saw her was in her little golf cart rushing off from one ride to the next ride to the food court to this. I mean, she never looked at anyone, never smiled. And so when I saw her go by, I knew she was the owner, knew her name. So I called her, hello, Miss Charlotte. And she turned around and looked at me, and she gave me this half grimace, half smile. It made me think, she doesn't even know how to smile, you know? I really thought that. And I think she hadn't been smiling so much, and no one said anything nice to her ever, because she was, like I said, only going to disasters, and when things were going wrong, she had to correct. But anyway, the next time I saw her, she smiled, and she said hello back. And then I was walking with a group out to our areas in the morning, and she came by, and she stopped. She said, "Good morning, and I hope you have a good day," and she took off. Well, the girl that was rocking next to me didn't look side to side. She just sat there stoically, and she said, "Wow, she's never stopped to say hello to me, much less wish me a happy day." So I started realizing there is a change that one person can make just by being an encourager. I encouraged her. I encouraged every patron that came. I encouraged the other lifeguards. And there was a huge change. And I knew there was a change because I got a call that summer from the owner. And she said, "Kevin, I need all my lifeguards to be like you. I want you to be our aquatics director." So I thought, oh, yeah, I guess she did notice me. So the point was, I explained to her that I'm a part-time pastor, and that's a calling, and I would have to give that up to be able to do what she wanted me to do. But she called me back again. She said, "Well, just tell me how many hours you can give me next summer and tell me how much you have to get paid," and basically said, "We'll do it." You know. So she said, I want you here. I want your influence here as much as you can give to us. I was kind of a sidetrack, but I'm just telling you that whatever you think is a small thing as far as encouraging someone else at any particular time, don't neglect to do it if you think about it. Go ahead and do it. So I'm going to talk about touch. I already have a little bit. You know, I really love hugs, so if you need a hug today, I'd be happy to give you one because you'll be encouraging me at the same time. I had a man that was in church. And everybody knows that when you come into our church in Bowling Green, you're going to get a hug. Unless you don't want a hug, because you don't want to be someone who hugs someone who does not get encouraged by a hug. There are some people that their emotional tanks are drained by that. It may be their past experiences. You know, I'm a man, so for a woman, you have to be very careful. I don't want you to go overboard in doing something like this. But when you know someone likes hugs, it's perfectly all right. Everybody at our church in Bowling Green likes hugs except for Mr. Tuttle. And I knew when I came up to Mr. Tuttle, I'd give him a handshake and move on. Do you know, after about 5 years of being there, he came up to me one time and says, "Kevin, I guess it'd be okay if you gave me a hug." I gave him the biggest hug. I hope I didn't break his back. But he encouraged me so much by letting me give him a hug. And then when he'd come, I'd give him a hug. When he left, I'd give him a hug. Sometimes I'd get busy, and almost everybody was left, and all of a sudden he'd come up and says, "Kevin, I haven't had my goodbye hug yet." He became someone who actually enjoyed hugs. At least he did for me. You know, one time I said this at a feast site in my sermon, and the next day he came up to me beaming from ear to ear. He said, because I said it like this, I said, "Well, there is a man that doesn't like hugs in my church. I wouldn't want to embarrass Mr. Tuttle." Oh, I didn't mean to mention his name. He told me the next day he came back, he really believed he had the Guinness Book of World Records for the most hugs in one day. So he was excited about that. Anyway, it may be just a touch on the shoulder. It may be a handshake. It may be some type of encouragement that you can do. But I'm telling you that some people's love language is touch. And then what about quality time? This one's a big one. Because, you know, sometimes I talk to people and I can tell they're not paying attention to me. I can tell they're off to something else and they're not there with me. You know, you feel immediately that someone doesn't care if they're not looking you in the eye or actively concentrating on what you have to say. Sometimes it even comes through on phone calls. You can tell someone's distracted or they're not paying attention to you on the phone call. I'm telling you, doing the opposite is really encouraging. When someone comes and is talking to you, especially it's little or serious, whatever, if you'll try to take the time and focus on them and spend that time and try not to be thinking about what you're going to say next, but think about what they're saying. One of the hardest things we have to do, myself included, is when someone is introduced to you and they mention their name, your brain is going over here and over there saying, "What do I say next? What am I going to do here?" Because it's the first time you've met them. And then all of a sudden you say, "I don't even remember their name." It's been proven that one of the biggest encouragements is someone to hear their own name spoken. So if you'll think about their name and say their name when you come by, you know, that could be all that they need for that encouragement for that day. You know, it's interesting. I got a note from Mr. Kennebec that was CC mailed to me. I think he must send you a note every week. Oh, what a kind pastor. Some things he's done, I realize, you know, you're probably missing your pastor because of how much he cares. But anyway, sometimes you don't know for sure if God's inspiring this topic for this particular time, But when I started reading his, well, let me just read the part that I wanted to. He said, encourage. The Sabbath is a time to encourage and be encouraged. That is one of the main purposes for us to fellowship at services, to encourage one another. It's also a good time to phone someone or visit those who can't make it to church. Paul tells us, therefore, encourage one another and build one up, just as you are doing, 1 Thessalonians 5:11. It was already in my notes. I've already read that to you. And then he continues, this is also a part of service. It's also a part of encouraging others. Serve. The Sabbath is a time to serve God and each other. We serve through fellowship. Fellowship, what is fellowship? Quality time. Spending with other people. Fellowship may be giving them a hug or a handshake. Touch. Fellowship may be, you found out that they're doing something and it's exciting for them and you say, wow, good on you, mate. That's encouragement. He says, we should serve through fellowship, through helping other at services, through greeting others. Working at services, what is that? It's a gift. The people out there, the sound people that set this up, the people that I had to contact even before I came because it's so well organized here. The people that are translating for the Spanish-speaking brethren. That's service. That's a gift to other people. He says, through greeting others. We'd already talked about that, right? You know, some people say, I just don't feel comfortable with hugs. I don't give it to them, but I say, aren't you glad we don't live back in ancient Israel time? He says, what do you mean? Well, didn't it say there that the brethren greeted each other with a holy... Yeah, holy kiss. I'm not doing that, hey. It seems like that's all right too, right? You know, the French, they give a kiss on the left cheek and on the right cheek. So through greeting others, through special music and so many other ways, we serve through praying for others. We also serve as silent examples of dedication to God and His way of life. Often, it's the little acts of service that mean so much. Are we speaking the same thing? Mr. Shavey, your pastor, he's getting all the ministers to speak the same thing. And this is saying the same thing that I'm saying. Peter tells us, each of you should use whatever gift you have received to serve others as faithful stewards of God's grace in its various forms. Do not be slothful in zeal, be fervent in spirit, serve the Lord. 1 Peter 4:10 through 11. Do you have a favorite scripture? I'm going to venture to guess that that scripture as one that encourages you. Not hard, huh? I will never leave you or forsake you. How much more encouraging could it be? Are there any examples in the Bible where someone is being encouraged? The whole Bible is a book of encouragement. It tells you how much God loves us. It tells us how much God is going to serve and serving us. It tells us that He sent His only begotten Son. It tells us that our sins can be forgiven. It tells us we can live with God and His Son for eternity. What about the Bible could not be encouraging? At least the plan of God and the understanding that God wants us as children, His own children. I can tell you, you can read the entire book of Psalms and you'll find quite a bit of encouragement. I got a lot of scriptures here, and I can read these things of encouragement. But for time's sake, I'm not going to read them all, but I will tell you that there were some very encouraging people in the Bible. There was a man in the Bible that his name meant son of encouragement. Anyone know who that was? Well, I know some of you do. You're just not saying it. Barnabas. Do you know at a time when Saul was looked at as a pariah, someone who was looking out to kill Christians, the Christians avoided him like the plague. Even after he was converted, no one wanted to be near Paul, obviously, because you could lose your life. But there was a man who took a chance. There was a man who actually took upon himself to encourage Saul at the time. And that was Barnabas. Barnabas introduced him to the rest of the church so that they would accept him and understand that he's converted now. This is not the Paul you know. Paul couldn't have done such a strong work, I don't think, unless he was introduced first by Barnabas. Do you remember Jerusalem at one time? There was a problem and people were starving in the church, were hungry, needed things. And the wealthy people there sold some of their property, not all of it, but they sold some of their property and shared it with the rest of the church. Some people go to the scripture and say, well, isn't that what we're supposed to do? Sell all we have and spread it amongst? No, that's not what it says. You know, it's when someone is in need, God tells us to serve and help them. As a matter of fact, you don't want everyone to join in and have all the same monies, and I'll tell you why. Do you know there's a lot of people that play the lottery, and there are very, very, very few that win much in the lottery. But of those that want to win a million or more, you can do the research. If they won $1 million, do you think that they're happy in a year's time, in 2 years' time, in 3 years' time? You would not believe the percentage of the people who win over $1 million who's in 1 year are dead. Many of them in 1 year are worse off than they were when they started. If you're prepared to handle $1 million today and you want $1 million, you'd probably be able to handle $1 million and invest it, and it would still be here. It'd be greater. You would have invested it and made more money next year. Are we all ready for that? You know, the fact is that there's some professional athletes that are dirt poor, made millions of dollars when they played. Now they're dirt poor. I'm not saying that to say you shouldn't have $1 million. I'm just saying that sometimes we might pray for something. If you pray to win the lottery and you're entering the lottery, I would encourage you to look at the chances of winning and then say, well, maybe it'd be better for me to have my money and use it a different way. I'll give you another, for instance. I went to a math conference, of all places, Las Vegas. It's funny. It's a math conference. I walked through the casino, because you have to walk through the casino where they're gambling to get back to your hotel room or to get to any restaurant that's there in Las Vegas. And do you know, I passed by two guys that were doing nothing, sitting around. There's hardly anyone at the slot machines or anyone in the institution. And one was talking to the other and says, I don't understand it. There are 30,000 people here at this conference and hardly anyone is gambling. He didn't get the message. The people that gamble the least are mathematicians who know what it means to invest in Las Vegas. And I say invest because it's beautiful. They have beautiful shows that are free. They have circus on the hour, every hour for free. They have beautiful water shows at the Bellagio. If you're going there not gambling, there's some things that are beautiful. But the interesting thing is that math teachers understand the odds. In Las Vegas, they'll have signs that says, we got the loosest slots in town. We pay out 90%. People are going crazy getting into that casino. They pay out 90%. Do you know what they're hearing? Every time, I'm going to win 90% of the time. Do you know what the casino's telling them? For every dollar you put in, you're going to get 90 cents back. Do you see what I mean? I got off on that too much. My point is that, you know, sometimes we need something that we don't even realize that we need. Encouragement is that way. Sometimes we don't know how someone else is encouraged unless we get to know them and spend quality time with them. So it could be one of many different ways. So the Jerusalem church was kind, and when the needy needed help, they helped them. You know, I heard a story about frogs, and they were near the pond. Two of them fell into this hole, but they were on a ledge, so they were about 3 feet down. And one frog leaped up and he got up to about 2.5 feet. The other one leapt up and got about 2.5 feet. And then all the frogs gathered around and they started cheering them. And the frogs were jumping and jumping for all they were worth. And the cheering kept going until finally the frogs were so exhausted they were about ready to fall off the ledge. They couldn't even hold themselves up on the ledge. And so then they started saying, it's hopeless. Stop jumping. You're going to lose your life sooner by jumping. And the one frog fell over and died. The other one started jumping again. And he jumped a little higher. And they yelled louder, stop, you've got to stop. And he jumped a little bit higher and a little bit higher. He got up to 2 inches from the top of it. And they yelled with all their might. They didn't want him to use up all of his energy. And all of a sudden, he jumped out. And all the frogs were amazed. They asked him, what's going on? How come when we were telling you, stop. He kept going higher. And he said, with sign language, he said, I'm deaf. He thought they were still cheering for him. So that encouragement helped him to get the rest of the way. Obviously, you know, fake story, of course, but it still makes the point of what encouragement can do. As a matter of fact, there was a Christian psychologist that said, well, if I have the paper here, I'll read what he said. He said, his name is Larry Crabb. He said, the hurting people of the world, the men and women and the boys and girls of the world discouraged from the Murphy's Law of life, they did not always seek a psychiatrist. Their primary need was the love and care of a Christian community where they could find brothers and sisters in the Lord who would nurture and encourage them. You know, I'm not saying anything about psychiatrists because there are some cases that, you know, ministers, we don't know how to help some people. And you can consider them, you know, when the Bible says to have wise counsel, if they've studied for a long time about this, there's some things that they might be able to share. My point being is that there'd be a lot less people that were discouraged and unhappy if Christians were well focused on encouraging others. It would solve a lot of problems, not all of them, but it would solve a lot. We need encouragers. We need to become encouragers. You know, what's a more important time than now to become a source of encouragement for others? We're entering a time that's going to pretty soon be tribulation. I don't know what you think. Maybe it's already here. I don't know. The weird things that are happening today. It seems like we have a short time. And in the millennium, people are going to go into the millennium having seen possibly 9/10 of the world dying of disease or famine or other things. Do you think they're going to need someone who knows how to encourage? They're going to need you. One of your biggest jobs is to be able to lift people up and know how to encourage others. So let's practice that. Now before Passover, before it's that end time, let's become sources of encouragement.